Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to speak with Michigan Advance Editor-in-Chief Susan Demas about a rather satisfying column she wrote, blasting the moron American community for its willful ignorance and embrace of stuff like anti-vax bullshit. Then we're going to be joined by journalist and author Sarah Posner to talk about her focus, which is wingnut politics, especially the religious right and their new embrace of Hungary, which is and its leader, Viktor Orban, which is actually not so new, not as new as many of us think. But first, I think I need to have a moment of accountability with you folks, because I have gotten a few things very, very wrong of late. And I'm also trying to identify for myself why I got these things so wrong. So first up, let's talk about something we didn't discuss here. If you follow me on Twitter, you may know that I was absolutely convinced that Andrew Cuomo would not resign. I thought there was no chance. I said repeatedly that it just wasn't in his constitution. He wasn't capable of shame. He's had a sense of entitlement, blah, blah, blah. I wasn't the only one to get this wrong, of course. But I figured Cuomo would stick to his playbook. It's tried and true. He drags it out, drags out the accusation until the public is exhausted. He, at the same time, he is behind the scenes threatening and bullying and cajoling elected officials and the press. This is how he dealt with the fallout from the Moreland Commission, right? This was when he appointed this anti-corruption commission. They started looking at his cronies and he disbanded it. And it was a big scandal and he survived it by doing just what I just described, right? And I think the lesson here is that when it comes to political scandals, it's just impossible to hold on, no matter how narcissistic you are or how great your sense of entitlement, if the folks on your side, if the folks who you rely on for support abandon. Now, I'll tell you, my mom was mad about Cuomo resigning, and she's a good feminist. She wasn't mad that a powerful man was held accountable for being a dirtbag. She was mad at the double standard, right? Which is understandable. Nothing Andrew Cuomo was accused of even came close to the allegations against, say, Donald Trump. Matt Gaetz, the Florida congressman, he has not resigned. He's being probed for sex trafficking, for alleged sex trafficking, for allegedly paying for sex with an underage girl. And even if he's quote unquote innocent, if he was only, you know, paying 19-year-old college kids, that would still be grounds for resignation, right, from Congress, even if that doesn't get you in jail. It's much worse than anything Al Franken was accused of, right, the senator who resigned. The last governor of New York to resign, Eliot Spitzer, was only guilty of hiring high-priced sex workers, right? Adults, consensual, all that. It's quaint compared to, say, Representative Jim Jordan, the Republican congressman from Ohio, who continues to be the Republican congressman from Ohio, despite multiple allegations that he turned a blind eye to sexual abuse of minors in his charge when he was a high school wrestler. So there is a double standard. But as I said to my mom, the appropriate place to direct one's anger about this double standard is to the Republican base and the Republican elites who supported Trump despite dozens of allegations of sexual abuse and who stand by Matt Gaetz and Jim Jordan and others, right? That's their thing. And in this polarized environment, it doesn't matter if the other side is outraged, right? It doesn't matter if people on the other side call for your resignation. It matters when your side says enough. And their side doesn't do that, and our side did. And let's be clear, you know, Andrew Cuomo would not have resigned if he were a Republican. He would not have resigned. He wouldn't have had to resign. He called the investigation a witch hunt, which should sound familiar. Right. He said the media were being unfair to him, which should sound familiar. And if he were a Republican, that would be enough for his base. They would be happy to see that he was triggering the libs and they would think that it was a witch hunt and the media were being unfair. That's what Trump supporters think. That's, I'm sure, what Matt Gaetz's supporters think. And we should be happy that we are that we hold ours to a higher standard. We should be happy that we're better than that. So then the other thing that I got totally wrong, and we did talk about that. Of course, I did not think the 10 Senate Republicans would ever vote for a bipartisan infrastructure bill, if that meant giving Joe Biden a win. Again, I was wrong, wrong, wrong. And this one is a little more straightforward. The incentives for Republicans to support this bill were not hard to figure out. First and foremost, I think, this demonstrated that, you know, bipartisanship is still possible and whatever. The Senate can function with the filibuster. And that weakens the hand of people like me, right? People have been pressuring West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, and others to kill the filibuster. So, you know, you say, okay, we were saying, look, we can't pass anything in this Congress. Democrats control everything. We got to get rid of the filibuster and govern. And they made this move and they said, well, look, we passed a $1 trillion infrastructure bill, so you can obviously work with us. And also, so-called hard infrastructure is popular with the Republican base. It is popular with Republican donors. And Republicans hope that by passing this bipartisan deal, they can also persuade quote-unquote moderate Democrats to torpedo the more ambitious partisan spending bill that Democrats are moving forward at the same time. Also, just in the most straightforward way, like obstructing every single thing is generally a bad look, especially when like bridges are falling down and like the needs for infrastructure are so clear. Infrastructure improvements are so clear and so visual. So I think I got this one wrong because I overestimated the right's capacity for punishing apostasy, basically, right? For punishing Republicans who work with Democrats. Trump was calling out Republicans. I figured that the wingnut media would go all in and call them rhinos. I expected a lot more lies about what's in the bill. And I expected Republican senators to balk because of that. Because working with Democrats is like one of the worst betrayals a Republican office holder can make, according to much of the base, especially the MAGA base. But the conservative media did not go all in. There were not like a million bots demonizing the bill as a gun grab or whatever on social media. It was very low key, the opposition to this bipartisan bill. So it was mostly just Trump bitching about it, right? And he's not on Twitter. That dude's not even on Twitter. So I think that the conservative media are taking their cues as much from Mitch McConnell on things like this as from Trump. And maybe there's a recognition that Trump is not the Trump, despite the loyalty of his base, his hardcore MAGA base, is not the political genius that he thinks he is. And of course, there is safety in numbers. 19 Republicans voted for the bipartisan framework. If it were a smaller number, they would have taken a lot of shit from their base, but it wasn't a close vote. So none of them can be held responsible individually, right? There was no one Republican who could say, oh, you tipped it over, because they had 9 votes to spare. So lesson learned, right? Republicans aren't as terrified of their base as we sometimes think. Like, that's a cliche. Democrats hate their base, Republicans fear theirs. But I guess sometimes it doesn't work out that way. Oh well, I'll try to do better. In the meantime, we'll take a quick break and I'll be right back with Susan Dimas. Stay tuned.
Show me, don't tell me that you're uptight. You must tell me that you're
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and maybe I'm still wrong, but I'm joined now by someone who I think I got it right this week. Susan Demas is the editor-in-chief of Michigan Advance, and she joins us to talk about her piece that I think put her finger on something. Susan, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. Susan has written a piece that channels what a lot of us are feeling right now, I think. It's titled, We've Coddled Ignorance for Years, Now We're All Paying the Price with COVID. And listeners can check it out at michiganadvance.com. First of all, this was one of those rants. Do you love writing while you're angry?
I have to admit, I kind of do.
Me too.
It may not be the healthiest process, but...
Definitely not.
You know, sometimes you get off on a tear, and it does make you feel a little bit better.
It does. And I'll tell you, I don't know if it's the case for you, but for me, when I'm angry, it just flows. There's no effort at all. It just comes out.
Yeah. I don't like writing, a feature piece or, a straight news story angry, but it can work with columns.
Absolutely. And I just want to give readers a little flavor here. Susan writes, and I quote, I am tired of sugarcoating it, which is so refreshing. I am tired of the perennial hectoring to both sides of the pandemic, like we mindlessly do with political coverage. The 40% who can't be bothered to get jabbed because they know more than doctors, or they understand freedom better than the rest of us, or just know that the magnetic 5G is going to be injected in their veins, are why people continue to needlessly die, and they are why life continues to be hell for the rest of us. Ugh. So I feel like something has shifted in the last week or two. For a while, the legacy media ran story after story about people they called vaccine hesitant, and a lot of those stories were exceedingly gentle, right? They treated them with kind of kid gloves. But the past week or two, I think we've seen the emergence of a new kind of narrative, which is that responsible Americans who have gotten vaccinated and are also the same people who wear masks and don't freak out about everything being done to mitigate this pandemic are done coddling these idiots. There's been a bunch of articles about this. We want to get past the pandemic and go out to bars and whatever, and these jackasses are holding us back. The vaccinated are mad, and you're seeing stories about that. Have you seen that shift?
I think it's palpable. A lot of us got vaccinated as soon as we could, usually in the spring, when it was widely available. And we had like a couple months where like we could get back to bars and restaurants and go to concerts and travel. And, wear a mask if you're comfortable. Don't wear a mask, for the first time in over a year. And then because of Delta and probably Lambda to come and whatever else is next, it's basically right back to where we were before.
Yes.
If you want to be safe, you got to wear a mask. Think twice if you want to, get back to the office and all the stuff that you used to do. And, you're going to have to really self-select with your friend group. And, honestly, I think part of the problem is that, experts and Democrats like the president put a little too much faith in people who had not shown that they deserved it. I mean, these are the same folks that were screaming about masks back in last April. These were the people who were making scenes at, their local restaurant, because they wanted to have a table of five and only four, were allowed. We saw this pattern. We knew where this was going. Plus, we have a very healthy anti-vaxxer movement in this country long before COVID. And, I think this, the guidance that the CDC put out in May, and it was very well intentioned. Hey, you're vaccinated. You don't have to wear a mask. Everything's cool now. We're all going to get through this together. It's going to be normal. It doesn't work if you don't have to prove that you're vaccinated, because
right.
We've already seen so many bad actors. It can't be that every store I went into, everybody was vaccinated. It just doesn't work that way. I don't think that I have the Midas touch like that. So I think we're those of us who have really tried and really tried are just sick of things. And, you know, if the 40% does not get it together, this is not going to be just a problem for the next few months. This is going to be the next decade.
Yeah, or at least the next year and a half or so. I mean, we are vaccinating people. At some point, one assumes we will get to herd immunity unless a new variant emerges in the unvaxxed. In the meantime, that is vaccine resistant. And this is the big thing.
Yeah.
There is nothing dumber than this idea that this is a personal decision. That if you want to get vaxxed, you get vaxxed. If you don't want to get vaxxed, don't get vaxxed. The problem with that, and it's striking to me how people who are otherwise seemingly intelligent sometimes take this tact. That is an individual analysis for fundamentally a societal problem. We will not get out of the pandemic while we have this virus raging through the unvaccinated population and giving opportunities for new variants to emerge. And I should point out that that includes internationally. We have a duty to make sure that we're vaccinating not only Americans, but people around the world, because forget about the morality, even in our own self-interest, it is very, very important that we get past the pandemic before a variant emerges that manages to elude the vaccines that we have, which are miracles. And I also want, Susan, I'm sorry to babble, but I need to babble a little bit because we're in a kind of tricky position where we have to be careful to warn people of the dangers of this without downplaying the significance of the vaccines, because the vaccines are miraculous. So where we're at right now, according to the latest data, which I track very carefully, is that it appears that the mRNA vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, after a while, their efficacy against becoming infected with the Delta variant seems to be lower than we were hoping, or that a lot of people are saying, right? It's not that right. You're protected 95%, but your risk of ending up with a severe illness where you go into the hospital or you go into the morgue, they're super effective for that. So you should be careful and you should mask up indoors if you're in a place where there's high community transmission, because you don't want to get a breakthrough infection. But at the same time, if you're not vaccinated, get vaccinated, because if you do catch COVID, it will not kill you that way. Sorry. I've said pretty consistently since early on that making COVID partisan, turning it into a culture war issue, was a choice with disastrous consequences, right? Trump set the right on this course early on, in large part because he figured that downplaying the pandemic would keep the stock market propped up, blah, blah, blah. And I think we can only estimate how many people have died avoidable deaths as a result of this. So now we see these guys like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, Texas Governor Greg Abbott, many, many others adopting that strategy because it's what their base wants, being pro-COVID effectively. Mm-hmm. It's part of positioning oneself to run for the presidency perhaps, or re-election in red states. So do you think, to what degree do you think the backlash we're seeing from vaccinated people is the flip side of that polarization?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, you know, people who wanted to do the right thing, you know, might be more on the liberal side. I mean, being tolerant is kind of part of our DNA, right? You know, it's like, let's have a debate, you know, ideas are important. And, you know, I want to hear what you have to say. And I want to make, you know, this very, you know, reasoned case about why vaccines are miracles and how we can all work together. And then just for a year and a half, on the other side, it's just been one conspiracy theory after another, and it's been anger and bile. I live in Michigan. We were at the forefront with these like violent protests at our capitals, just, you know, for like mask requirements.
Yes.
I mean, like, and then a few months later, it turns out, oh yeah, some of these people were trying to kidnap and kill our governor. So it's like, it's not just like you're anti-mask, you know, you're really crossing the Rubicon for some of these folks. And it's just, it's a lot, I think, for those of us who have really tried to keep ourselves and our families safe and our neighbors, and just to see that they're just not budging And it's pretty disturbing to see what people, especially in red states, are willing to put up with. I mean, these are death rates that, you know, if you told people before COVID, you know, we'd have 620,000 Americans dead, you know, for anything, like, we would never let that happen, you know, in a year and a half. No way. We're Americans. Come on. And now it's just kind of like, hey, it's the price of doing business. I mean, you've got parents at a wealthy Tennessee school district who are screaming at doctors who are saying, we want to save your children. We want a mask requirement. And they're saying, we're going to find you and hunt you down. It's just such a disconnect. And, you know, I think we really have tried. But if that's the kind of hostility that we've got, and some of our friends and family are getting these breakthrough infections, it's like, you know, enough. That's why you have companies like Google and Walmart that are mandating vaccines, because they want to keep their business. They understand how the economy works. And, you know, honestly, a lot better than these Republican governors seem to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should point out that, first of all, not everybody can get vaccinated. So we're not talking about people who have compromised immune systems, certainly people who are under 12 years old. And I also want to stress that, and this is a point that I made on the show before, it is less polarized than many people would have us believe, this issue, right? Polls consistently find large super majorities in favor of masking, in favor of all of these things. What we have is a very, very loud, very vocal, noisy, belligerent, stupid minority, right? So we're not even talking about all Republicans by any means. We're not talking about none of these anti-mask idiots being Democrats in the same vein, right? But my own anger tends to be directed at that group who believe bullshit that they see on Facebook, in large part because, as you said, like, they are belligerently stupid. They're the same people who refuse to wear masks. They're the same people who throw these temper tantrums. They're less likely to distance, and their reasons are bad, right? So, and these are the same people who insisted we let the virus rage because mitigation efforts hurt the economy. Now, CNN reported today that airlines are now seeing people canceling trips because of the Delta variant. They're seeing fewer bookings. So we had this, like, you know, everybody's running back to the airlines. We're all going to take our vacations. And it seems like there's a pullback on that. It seems to me like air travel is a perfect place for a vaccine mandate. Polls find that a significant share of the voluntarily unvaccinated, that is the people who are eligible to get vaccinated, would get the jab if they had to do so for air travel. And it's unambiguously an area of federal regulation. So these death cult governors, Ron DeSantis, Abbott, they wouldn't have anything to say about it. And it would be satisfying also, I think, to make anti-vaxxers take cross-country bus trips.
Yeah, that would be great.
And also, I think we'd reduce the incidence of air rage, because people who are who hate the idea of wearing masks are also the people who are more likely, let's face it, to drink too much and start getting into a fight with flight attendants or anything like that.
Yeah, it's bizarre that so many of the airlines, you know, won't do it. You know, they keep telling us
they're not even asking their own people.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's great. I get your messages, Delta, that, you know, you're cleaning your planes, you know, like nobody's business. I'm not concerned about, you know, getting it off of the armrest. I'm concerned about, you know, the fact that perhaps the flight attendant who is serving me is unvaccinated.
Right. Right. And I just think that a federal mandate would be a way that you could probably increase the vaccination rate significantly in a relatively short amount of time. Remember, we have vaccines are widely available. They are free. They are safe. 170 million people have had them with minimal side effects. There's just no reason to not do it, except there seems to be a timidity about doing this. for the same reason that you talk about in the piece, like we've given a veto point, we've given a veto to these people. Let me just read another little thing that you write later in the piece. You write, and I quote, "How did we get to a point where the proudly ignorant wield this much power?" And you say there, throughout your career in journalism, there's been one constant. You are never, ever to make people who are loudly intellectual, knowingly spew lies, and publicly pat themselves on the back for it, feel dumb. That is the sin of elitism, and there is nothing worse. That's good writing, Susan.
Thank you.
Sure. Why is that the case? I mean, journalists tend to be well-educated and inquisitive and reality-based. Is it just the effectiveness of the right in working the refs?
I think that's part of it. I've had many discussions with like people who, you know, run either somewhat liberal editorial pages or are kind of centrist, and a lot of their arguments are people can just decide, you know, what's true and what's not very easily, you know, so there's no harm in us putting out these lies, you know, like the Wall Street Journal did for Mike Pence last year, that there was no second wave, because, you know, any reasonable person knows that he's full of it. So, you know, but just to show how, you know, we're just all about the marketplace of ideas, we'll let him have a column. And then, you know what, we'll have a doctor write a column too, and it's all good. And, you know, I think we've seen, especially with the rise of social media, with YouTube and Facebook and all these mediums that bad actors exploit, you know, people are going to believe a Facebook post from their uncle a lot more than a piece from a doctor in your local paper at this point. That's where we're at.
Yeah, it's true. And I mean, journalists have many biases like everybody else. Everybody walking on this planet has multiple biases. And one of them is a urban bias. They tend to have a pro-education bias, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a tendency to compensate for that and to believe that you must live in a bubble, right? Like you must live in a bubble. You hear it all the time. So you got to get outside your bubble. Before I let you go, let me ask you, what is happening now in Michigan? As you mentioned earlier, you're a swing state with a Democratic governor who's become like kind of public enemy number one among wing nuts. What is the COVID fight looking like?
So right now, our state is not quite as bad as others, although, you know, we're seeing rising cases like everyone else. We do not have a mask mandate. I don't think the governor is going to really issue any new COVID restrictions. Since the spring, she's, you know, really focused on vaccinations. We're middle of the pack on them. You know, it's maybe by fall we'll hit 70% if we're lucky. So I think that Governor Gretchen Whitmer could be more aggressive about it. I also understand that, you know, at this point, you know, she's got polling. Perhaps people aren't persuadable anymore, but, you know,
yeah,
we've just seen that, you know, the recommendations don't really do anything.
Yeah.
So I'm really hoping that we don't get to the point of like Florida or Texas and we're on fire. But I mean, looking at the history of this virus, that's probably where most of us are heading, unless, you know, you live in Vermont where you've hit herd immunity, or San Francisco where my brother lives, you know, I mean, and I'm, yes, those are liberal bubbles, but you know what? I'd rather live there and be able to survive this thing a lot better.
Yeah, everybody wears a mask out in San Francisco.
Even
Susan Demas, I believe we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Folks, you can read Susan's work at michiganadvance.com, all one word. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, then be right back with Sarah Posner.
Cage.
Welcome back. I am very happy to welcome an old friend to the show. Sarah Posner and I got started writing for a group blog many years ago, in the height of the liberal blogosphere era, I guess you would call it.
Stop making me feel old.
Well, I'm ancient, of course. And she has gone on to become one of the best journalists on the religious right beat and an author. Her latest book is Unholy, How White Christian Nationalists Powered the Trump Presidency and the Devastating Legacy They Left Behind. Sarah, welcome to the show. It's been a long time.
Thanks for having me again.
It's been too long. You know, I've wanted to have you on to talk about the book, but we just haven't had a chance to schedule it with the election last year and then the pandemic and all that. So I want to talk to you about the American right's infatuation with Viktor Orban and Hungary. But can you talk a little bit about the book first?
Well, the book is about how the religious right and the alt-right came together to support Trump. So it's about how white evangelicals fell for Trump, not because they made a transactional handshake that he would give them the Supreme Court justices that they wanted, and in exchange they would provide the voters for his victory. But it was really more intense than that, with regard to how they view their role in American society and how he viewed his ability to, or his willingness to, crush liberalism or crush democracy or crush political correctness, that the bond between them was deeper than a transactional handshake. At the same time, he was riling up white nationalists and anti-government extremists and neo-Nazis. And all of these groups came together to support him. And so I look at that, but I also look at the history, the long history of the religious right and its issues surrounding race, and also how white nationalism has really been a feature of the American conservative movement for many decades. And so when you look at it from that lens, it's not as surprising that seemingly these evangelicals who have talked about, family values and, anti-abortion and save the babies and religious freedom, that they would have come together in support of Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, the question of why evangelicals became the most loyal group of supporters for a guy like Trump, who is a phony Christian sleazebag from New York City, who used to be pro-choice until he decided to run as a Republican, that's gotten a ton of attention. And I've never really thought that superficial transactional, trade for the judges and Roe v. Wade explained it.
Right.
Right. And there was always something like, his enthusiasm for punishing common enemies, right?
Yes. Seems
like that's a big, big piece of it.
It's a big piece of it. And also, he really knew how to play to their grievances, right? So they feel like they've been inaccurately portrayed in the press, for example. So they don't really have a lot of objection to him calling it fake news or the enemy of the people, because they feel like the press has made fun of them about the war on Christmas or something like that, right? So he really understood how to tap into their sense of displacement from mainstream culture and his willingness to try to make their view of, preserving our Christian heritage or preserving our Western values or our Judeo-Christian values front and center.
He has always, despite inheriting $412 million from his father's tax ripoff scheme, mm-hmm. and, having everything given to him on a silver plate, he has always had grievances. He's always been quick to express grievances. Everybody is out to get him. It's an extension of his narcissism, but I absolutely see how that kind of, gels with this worldview. And I think that on the far right, what do they have besides bigotry and these kind of grievances, this persecution complex? It's really these are the guiding lights for the increasingly extreme far right in this country. Again, the book is called Unholy, How White Christian Nationalists Powered the Trump Presidency and the Devastating Legacy They Left Behind. I have not read it yet. I I'm going to read it, but I have read Sarah's previous book, God's Prophets, and it was excellent. I learned a lot from it, and I know that she's a really rigorous writer. Anyway, thank you for writing these books, Sarah. Let's talk about Viktor Orban. He's the autocratic ruler of Hungary. If you're not familiar with him, that's okay. He has campaigned on like defeating George Soros and the LGBTQ agenda. He has launched a full-throated assault on much of his country's civil society. He's punished the independent media. He's gone after universities. He's gone after the Hungarian judiciary, if that sounds familiar to you at all. He has been called kind of like a more competent, less goofy Donald Trump, or, you know, Putin.
Or Trump before Trump.
Trump before Trump. Let's listen to a little clip of Tucker Carlson, the Fox News host, broadcasting from Hungary this very week.
What does Viktor Orban believe? Just a few years ago, his views would have seemed moderate and conventional. He thinks families are more important than banks. He believes countries need borders. For saying these things out loud, Orban has been vilified. Left-wing NGOs have denounced him as a fascist, a destroyer of democracy. Last fall, Joe Biden suggested he's a totalitarian dictator. We've watched all of this from the United States, and we've wondered if what we've heard could be true. So this week, we came to Hungary to see for ourselves. We sat down with Orban for a couple of long conversations, including one this morning. In a moment, we'll show you some of that, and you can make up your own mind about it. But first, a word about Hungary. Even if you understand that the American news media lie, it is always bewildering to see the extent of their dishonesty. Nothing prepares you for it. We've read many times how repressive Hungary is. Freedom House, an NGO in Washington that's funded almost exclusively by the U.S. government, describes Hungary as much less free than South Africa, with fewer civil liberties. That's not just wrong, it's insane. In fact, if you live in the United States, it is bitter to see the contrast between, say, Budapest and New York City.
So Tucker was feted and flattered over there. He returned the favor in a big way. The New York Times put it this way. On Wednesday, Mr. Carlson rode a military helicopter to Hungary's southern border with Serbia to inspect the chain link fence Mr. Orban's government erected to keep migrants from entering the country. He praised the government's efforts. Mr. Carlson was also slated to speak at a youth event on Saturday hosted by a talent management institute on which Mr. Orban's government has lavished billions, and he is filming a documentary about Hungary during his stay there, which is slated to air on Fox Nation. So a lot of people were like, what is going on here? But this is actually something you've been covering for a while. Back in 2019, you wrote about the religious right's growing affection for characters like Orban and others, Eastern Europeans. And you wrote about how what started or appeared to be a kind of affinity between the American right and these autocratic leaders based on animosity towards gays and lesbians and transgender people and all of that gradually kind of resulted in a growing appreciation for their anti-democratic tendencies, right? And, yeah. And again, this is not just Orban. Can you expand on that?
So Viktor Orban was one of the leading... He was on the leading edge of these rising autocrats in former communist countries in Eastern and Central Europe, instituting these anti-feminist, anti-LGBTQ initiatives under the frame of, you know, preserving family, preserving our heritage, preserving our Christian values. And these things definitely drew the attention of figures on the American religious right, particularly those who interact with their counterparts in foreign countries. So I'm not sure that at the time, we're talking in the, you know, early 2010s, that your average Christian right grassroots activist would have been necessarily aware of this, but this was sort of the start of a very cozy relationship. And so by 2018, when I traveled to Moldova, where there was this conference called the World Congress of Families, the year before that, it had been held in Budapest. And it's a conference that's organized by figures on the American religious right, but they bring together, like I said, their counterparts from all these different countries. And it's extremely, you know, far to the right. The people who attend this conference are natalists. They invoke a lot of sort of fascistic imagery and ideology surrounding the family and the heritage of a nation and a nation, obligation to protect its heritage and so forth. And when I interviewed Americans who were there, who were attendees or participants in the conference, and asked them about Orban, because this was at a time when pro-democracy academics and activists around the world were really raising alarm bells about what Orban was doing in terms of gerrymandering to guarantee his party's forever control of the parliament in Hungary, his crackdowns, as you said, on a free press, his sacking of the judiciary, and all of these other anti-democratic moves. And when I asked these American religious right activists about that, their response was, well, you know, these are just procedural things. We really like the way he's preserving the family or traditional values. And one of them even rejected the idea that it was anti-democratic because Hungarians still go to the polls every 4 years and vote. And so how can it be not a democracy if that's what happens? But as we know from our own experience now here in the United States, yes, that there can still be corrosion of democratic institutions while ostensibly people still have the ability to go vote in elections. So they were really buying into the whole idea of the way Orban himself put it, having an illiberal democracy. So basically stomping out liberal values like equality and dignity for everybody, regardless of their, you know, sexual orientation or ethnicity or whatever. And also his disdain for democratic institutions and civil society. And so that really opened my eyes to the ways in which they not only were okay with that as a model, Orban being a model for other countries, but actually being a model for the United States. And it goes a long way to understanding why they, a lot of them continue to support Trump's claim that the election was stolen, or at least support the claim that our elections are rife with fraud.
You know, if you think that you are not dealing with a political dispute, but engaged in some sort of spiritual warfare with the evil doers, it makes a certain amount of sense that you would accomplish your goals by any means necessary. I mean, it naturally follows.
Yes. And so these activists believe or maintain that, say, equal rights for transgender people is something that's satanic. And if Satan is bringing that to America, well, we need to do whatever we can to fight that, because we don't want America to be, which, you know, God intended to be a Christian nation. We don't want America to be overtaken by this satanic force.
Now, whenever we talk about the right, there is this kind of blend of ideology and grifting, right? So yeah. Tucker Carlson, let me just, again, according to the New York Times, Tucker Carlson has a family connection with the Hungarian leader. His father, Richard Carlson, is listed as a director of a Washington-based firm that has lobbied for Mr. Orban in the United States. In 2019, the firm, Policy Impact Strategic Communication, blah, 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 disclosed in a lobbying filing that it coordinated an interview, blah, blah, it doesn't matter. So this is an advocacy group, a DC advocacy group, and Carlson's father is involved. So Carlson's father has been working this. And you wrote a piece for, was it the American Prospect? No, it was
the New Republic.
The New Republic,
yeah.
Which I have here in another tab. You know how that works when you have like, yes, a million, you know, a million tabs open. I'm one of those guys. I have so many unread emails in my inbox and then tabs. So here it is, the New Republic, Right Makes Might. By Sarah Posner. You could check that out. But you wrote about how support for Hungary and and Orban was a fringe proposition until Orban started getting into the, like, let's cozy up with Republican lobbyist thing.
Yes. 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 So when Orban had been prime minister of Hungary from 1998 to 2002, so it overlapped a little with the presidency of George W. Bush, and he faced pushback from the Bush State Department over his fomenting of anti-Semitism and other anti-democratic moves. And he actually blamed his loss in the 2002 elections on the United States because he felt like they were being too harsh on him. But he hired an American Republican strategist to help him plot his return to power. And this was a strategist who's no longer with us. He died in 2017. But in 2008, Orban hired this guy named Arthur Finkelstein, who was a very high-profile, prominent, influential Republican strategist, consultant, who mentored the likes of Roger Stone and Paul Manafort. And he helped Orban return to power. Orban won in 2010, and he's been prime minister ever since. But after his initial return to power in 2010, and then again in 2014, he hired another Republican strategist, the former Florida Congressman Connie Mack, who had lost his bid for reelection in Congress and became a lobbyist. And Orban helped him become one of the highest paid foreign agents in Washington in 2015. Orban hired him to basically burnish his image in Washington, to make Orban seem like he was just a regular conservative, just like regular conservatives in the United States, who were under unfair assault by the likes of George Soros. And so Mack's job was to get op-eds placed, to talk to members of Congress, to talk to people in the State Department or the White House, and basically, you know, whitewash the fact that Orban was destroying Hungary's democracy.
And of course, as you detail in the piece, they kind of did the usual playbook where they cast Hungary as a victim. And they said, you know, they're suffering from, you know, all this unfairness from liberal democracies and the Western alliance and blah, blah, blah.
NATO, the European Union, George Soros, all the usual bogeymen, right? Yeah,
it's the same. And we see this theme over and over and over again. Where do you think this is all heading? I mean, it seems to me like there is more effective, like, transnational organizing on the far right than in more liberal circles.
Well, I don't know that it's more than in more liberal circles, but it's certainly quite robust. I would say that it's robust among people who you would sort of characterize as being in the religious right, people who are, you know, waging these assaults on LGBTQ rights and reproductive rights around the world. But it's also true in kind of more white nationalist circles. The cross-pollination between those in the United States and those in Europe and Eurasia are really quite remarkable. And I think Carlson is playing a role of bringing this even more to a grassroots audience. I think that the work of somebody like Connie Mack, who basically, you know, would help get, you know, op-eds published by the Heritage Foundation, or get a member of Congress like Dana Rohrabacher to hold a hearing to basically sanitize what Orban was doing, reached a sort of limited, you know, kind of DC audience. I think that the role that Carlson is playing is to really expand the audience for this sanitizing of Orban much more broadly. And I think that that's a very dangerous thing.
Yeah. This is all very dangerous. Sarah Posner, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Happy to do it. And thanks for having me.
Folks, Sarah's new book, again, it's called Unholy. Check it out at your local bookseller. I also want to thank Susan Demas and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Ross Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, I'd like to thank all of you fine, discerning people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.